Good morning. My name is Sylvia, and I will be your conference operator today. At this time, I would like to welcome everyone to the NBPE Investor Update Call. All lines have been placed on mute to prevent any background noise. After the speaker's remarks, there will be a question-and-answer session. If you would like to ask a question during that time, simply press star, then the number one on your telephone keypad. If you would like to withdraw your question, press the pound key. It is now my pleasure to turn the call over to Mr. Peter VanLee.
Hello, this is Peter VanLee, and welcome to the NB Private Equity Partners Investor Update Call. I'm here today with my colleagues John Boozer and Paul Daggett. The presentation we will be using this day, along with all of the other relevant information for the company, can be found on our website, www.nbprivateequitypartners.com. So let's begin with page two of the presentation. As all of you know, the objective of NBPE is to provide investors with the opportunity for capital appreciation and current income using and doing that by investing directly into private equity-backed companies using the sourcing and diligence capabilities of Neuberger Berman's $55 billion private equity platform. And we seek to do that at lower all-in costs to investors than other listed private equity vehicles. And we're pleased that we have been able to do this since 2007 and plan continuing to do this for many years into the future. A quick note about Neuberger Berman, the manager of NBPE on page three. As mentioned, we manage over $55 billion in private equity across primaries and secondary fund investments, direct equity investments, private credit, and other specialty strategies. We've been in the private equity business for over 30 years and have over 140 dedicated private equity professionals on four continents. And we make use of this full range of capabilities and resources to build the portfolio for NBPE. So I'd now like to hand it over to John, who will talk a bit about the recent performance in NBPE. John?
Yeah, thank you, Peter. So I'm on page four, and we have key performance highlights for NBPE on that page. So starting in the upper left, the performance for the last 12 months ended end of May 2018. The NAV per share total return in U.S. dollar basis was 11.9% in a return, and the share price, as you see in great in pounds, was down 3.8% as the currencies moved in different directions. In the lower left, you'll see the cash flows as we've started out this year have been strong. $94.2 million has come back from our investments, and we paid in through that point in time $34 million into new investments. Also, we made a distribution earlier in the year of $12.2 million to the shareholders. Going to the upper right of the page, the capital position is very strong. We have 358% adjusted commitment coverage ratio, so plenty of assets to cover our future commitments. And then the dividend at this point, based on our share price, is 3.6% annualized dividend yield on the share price. It's 2.9% annualized dividend yield on the net asset value of the company. So page five has some detailed statistics on NBPE as of the end of December and then as of the end of May, and we'll hit just a few of those. You'll see if you go to the fifth line, it's a total private equity fair value of $920 million. And you'll see as you look at the lines above that, it's made up principally of equity investments of $680 million, direct income investments of 144, and then our legacy fund investment portfolio continues to wind off. You see it's down to $95.6 million, and on the right, at December, it was 107, so down $12 million as things have rolled off over the first 5 months of this calendar year. Our credit facility borrowings at the end of May were down to $15 million as of at that point from $60 million at the end of the year, 5 months earlier. And you'll see at the bottom our net asset value numbers per share are laid out. Pro forma for the dividends paid during the year, $17.67 of net asset value, up from $17.45 at the end of the December. If you move to page six, you'll see a diversification analysis of our portfolio. We continue to be North American weighted at 82% on the top left. You'll see on the lower left of the page that our industry diversification continues to be very wide. On the upper right, you'll see that company size, we continue to focus on small and mid-cap for the predominant part of our portfolio, 78%. And vintage year, you'll see the fact that we are principally in the direct co-investments in companies, as well as the debt investments of companies at this point. You'll see that from 2014 forward, if you add up those percentages, 87% of our portfolio is less than 5 years old, and just 13% more than really 4.5 years old. So we continue to have a high level of return of on our investments of realizations and then the need to reinvest at a significant pace. Page 7 shows the net asset development starting on the left at December 2017, our NAV of $17.45 per share. This is in dollars, of course. And if you go to the right at $17.42, basically if you go one step in from the right, you'll see the 25-cent share of dividend that was paid, which, given the 3-cent decline, covers the 22 or takes out of the equation the 22% increase, 22-cent increase of the other numbers. So on the left side, you'll see we had realized gains, 66 cents, markdowns of 39 cents, and yield and income and dividends coming in from our portfolio of 16 cents as the big movers of the portfolio during the first 5 months of this year. And then on page 8, you'll see the returns, and we have the returns laid out for what has occurred during 2017, during the 12 months ended May of 18, and I'll focus on that column predominantly, and then 3-year and 5-year returns as well. So you can see both for 2017 and May of 18, last 12 months, the direct equity investments continue to perform well. They are the largest part of our portfolio, of course. The income investments, which can be subject to mark-to-market in very thinly traded debt, has performed at 5.3% during 2017, 0.8% during the first 5 months of this year. And the fund investments, which were up 4.4% as they continue to wind down in 2017, are marked down 1% this year. Again, as you know, we haven't made a fund investment for about 7 years now, and those are wind-up positions, and they continue to wind down over time. And then finally, page 9, and I alluded to this a little bit earlier, we have a very active portfolio, constantly turning over, a very young portfolio at any particular time, as many of our investments are realized in each of the years, as you see. Since the start of 2015, so 15, 16, 17, and a partial year here in 18, we've had over $975 million come back, which is basically the size of our whole portfolio has been returned. And as a result, we're constantly reinvesting in our portfolio. You can see for the year 2018, the 5 months year to date, the realizations have been $94 million, and as of at the end of May, we reinvested $34 million at that time. So, Paul, I'm going to turn over to Paul Daggett, who's going to go more specifically into our portfolio.
Great. Thank you. So I am on slide 10, which looks at the direct equity portfolio. And as you can see, today we have 86 direct equity investments with $680 million of fair value. On the right-hand side of the page, we show the top 10 investments, which makes up about 34% of the equity portfolio. And really, I think that there's a few important points to make here. First of all, if you look at the diversification for these, it's very well diversified even within this top 10. So the only industries you'll see twice among these top 10 are financial services and business services. There are 8 different financial sponsors involved in these investments, so again, well diversified by the relationships that we have. And then in terms of vintage year, there are 6 2017 investments, 2 in 16, 2 in 14, and this ties back to the point that John made on the some of the younger investments in the portfolio. First of all, on the 2017 investments, as we've mentioned over the last couple of calls, in general, we have increased the size of the investments. And so the 2017 investments are present in this top 10 by virtue of the fact the investments we made have been larger in that $20 to $25 million range, at least in these six investments. And then the 2016 and 2014 investments that are on this page because they are performing very well. So all of them are marked up significantly, and that's why they've gotten into this top 10 by fair value. Overall, I think the portfolio is becoming more concentrated. The top 30 investments make up about two-thirds of the portfolio today, and that is something that I think we'll continue to focus on over time. And then really, I think the other important point to make on this page is that 10% of this portfolio is in Publix, which should be a future source of liquidity as those positions are sold down by the underlying sponsors over time. I'll talk about the exits later, and the growth and valuation and leverage statistics are largely the same as we covered in the Q1 call, so I won't go through those again. So moving on to realizations and exits on page 11, we've had good liquidity continuing into 2018. 2017 was a very strong year. As you can see, we've completed three realizations at the top of the page. All of those were actually to financial sponsors. Those are all the completed investments. And then there are three subsequent exits, which are either ongoing or now completed, that we show at the bottom of the page. These are in Warranty Group, Council, and Black Knight. Warranty Group and Council have both been announced that they're both being sold to public companies, so they're both strategic exits. Which should be completed most likely in autumn, and we will receive public stock in both of those transactions, which obviously will increase our percentage. But then going the other way, Black Knight was an IPO that was in the portfolio in 2015. That was now completely exited by the underlying sponsor and by us. So that is obviously a decrease in the public positions, and that was a very successful investment for us. And then one other company to note, during June, Brightview, which is a KKR co-investment, completed an IPO. It IPO'd at 22, is traded generally in that range. So again, that will add to the public exposure that we have over time, and ultimately will be sold down and obviously converted to cash for us. The results of those exits are on page 12. On the left-hand side, we look at our gross multiple of invested capital. Again, we've described 2017 being a particularly strong year. 2018 has started out very well, albeit not quite as well as 2017. We're still at a 2.3 times our money on average on those full exits that we've made during the year, so we're pleased with the performance year to date. And on the right, we look at our valuation uplift on those exits. And so this is looking back three quarters, two quarters, and one quarter prior to the announcement of an exit where companies were marked in our portfolio. And again, you can see that over the last 3.5 years, we've seen an average uplift of almost 40% of our valuations versus where those exits occurred three quarters prior. So again, we think that shows that our valuations in those exits has been pretty conservative. Moving on to new investments on page 13, we have been relatively slow in the first 5 months of the year. I think that is more just circumstantial, the investments that we happen to have seen. We do obviously have cash available. We completed the zero dividend preference share offering in May. We've had cash available through the credit facility. But as you will have seen over time, we do sit on the sidelines when we don't see investments we like. We'll be more active when we do, such as we were in 2017. In the first 5 months of the year, we have been slower. The top two investments I covered on our Q1 call, so I'll focus on the other two. So C.H. Gunther is a family-owned business, or was a family-owned business, that was founded in 1851. So this is a primary buyout by the Pritzker Group. This is a company that produces branded and unbranded grain-based products and frozen foods, which sells to the food service, retail, and restaurant industries, has a really well-diversified and blue-chip customer base, and this really feeds into our theme of being relatively defensive in this environment. So these industries have grown almost always over the last 10 to 15 years. There's only one year where there was any decline in the industry as a whole, and this company grew every year over the last 10 years, both organically and through a buy and build strategy. So again, this is a company that we think we accessed at a reasonable price and should have good growth levers and hopefully stability should there be a recession during the holding period that we're in this company. Safefleet is a company that focuses on safety products and solutions for fleet vehicle manufacturers and operators. So these are in the emergency services, school bus, commercial vehicle, and then transit bus and rail industries, and they make all kinds of products used in safety and productivity. This is a very regulated market with high barriers to entry, which is one of the reasons we like it, and this is another buy and build approach. This is a very fragmented industry. It's a large platform, as I mentioned, with high barriers to industry, so it should be a very good platform to continue that buy and build strategy. Moving on to page 14, looking at the current equity valuation by year, and really the point I want to make on this slide is that it is a relatively young portfolio. However, if you look at the amounts of value we have in 2014, 15, and 16, these are companies which are 4, 3, 2 years old and really should be well into their execution period under private equity ownership. Hopefully, the 2014 and 15 companies in particular should be moving into a window where we could begin to see some liquidity. We've already seen some liquidity. We could continue to see liquidity. And as you can see, they have been marked up somewhat, but relative to where our exits have been, should those be indicative of where we what we can do in future, then there should be value accretion still possible in these companies. Whereas if you look at 2017 and 18, these are companies which are very early in the holding periods. They're held mostly at cost, although that there are a couple of companies doing particularly well that have been marked up significantly in 17. But in general, I think you can see we have this group of companies which is well into its holding period. We're pleased with how they're performing. We hope to be able to see liquidity coming from these companies over the next year or two. And then we have a reasonable amount also in those 16, 17 investments, which are much earlier in their holding periods, but again, generally are performing very well straight out of the gates. On page 15, we look at public versus private valuations, and I use this just to talk about the market environment as a whole. We generally do show this slide, and the trends continue to be the same, which is that US and European private valuations have continued to slowly tick upwards year by year and quarter by quarter. You'll see that we started in both cases, actually, in Europe and the US, at 8.8 times EV to EBITDA in those private markets, whereas today we've moved up to 10.2 times as of Q1 2018 in the US, 11.1 times in Europe, so a little bit higher in Europe than the US in the first quarter, but generally seeing the same trends. Clearly, public markets have behaved a little bit differently. The European market is up quite significantly in terms of those multiples. The U.S. market is up more, and part of that is down to the difference in the mix in the companies in those particular market indexes, where you see more technology in the U.S. But overall, obviously, the trend is most definitely positively upwards to a greater degree than those private valuations. That being said, private markets are highly competitive. Peter described our platform, and that becomes particularly important for us to be selective in this market environment, which is exactly what we're doing. I mentioned that our investment pace has been a bit slower. Again, that is more anecdotal and circumstantial. Just depends on the investments we see. But overall, I think there is value to be found in the market if you do have broad enough deal flow. And we actually have been very busy. We're working on a reasonable pipeline of investments for NBPE, some of which hopefully we'll complete and we'll see in our materials and in our discussions over future quarters. And then finally, on the income portfolio, On page 16, this slide actually looks pretty similar to what we've seen in the first quarter's presentation, and the reason for that is there have been very few exits and very few new investments in the income portfolio over that period of time. So this is an area that we are always considering what to do, what the best approach is. Clearly, we found it attractive to have a yield component over time. So as I mentioned, we're always looking at different ways to approach this market, but we're always very value conscious, and so that's why we've been a little bit slower in this portfolio in the last few months and few quarters. And with that, I'll hand it back to Peter to talk about historic performance as well as dividends and our capital position.
Thanks, Paul. So as you can see on page 17, we've had strong performance on a three-year, five-year, and since inception basis here at NBP. On an LTM basis through May, we generated an 11.9% total return on NAV. And while the share price has been roughly flat, that's on a dollar basis. On a sterling basis, shorter-term performance has been affected by the strength of the pound versus the dollar, while over the longer term, our sterling returns have been even greater than a dollar performance. As our asset mix is predominantly a U.S. dollar, as John described, and we would expect to continue to be predominantly dollar-based in terms of our assets over time. So there will continue to be a bit of a an effect on a sterling from a sterling NAV basis based on the dollar sterling FX rates. Let's turn to page 18 and look at our dividends and capital position. You can see that our LTM dividend yield was 3.6% based on our current share price, or 50 cents per share. Our dividend remains well supported, as last year we had $5.18 per share of realizations, including 29 cents per share of contractual yield from our income portfolio. So that's sort of backward looking, if you will, with regard to our dividends. The board of NBPE will be making a decision regarding the second half 2018 dividend shortly, and we'll be making an announcement in due course about that decision. So turning to page 19, you can see the share price and NAV development for NBPE for the 12 months through May on both the dollar and on a pound basis, but very much in line with what we've been talking about throughout the call here. So I think with that, I'd like to thank all of you for listening in and open it up to any questions that you may have.
Thank you, ladies and gentlemen. If you would like to ask a question, please press star, then the number one on your telephone keypads. Again, to ask a question, please press star one on your telephone keypads. We'll pause for just a moment to compile the Q&A roster. Your first question comes from Adam Kelly from JP Morgan.
Hi, guys. Just thinking a little bit more about the cash position. Obviously, there is quite a bit of cash available following the zero dividend preference share issue. You mentioned that investment had been quite slow in the first 5 months of the year. Is that something you expect to continue looking into the rest of 2018? And what kind of what would normal look like in terms of a run rate?
I think maybe just one thing to put things in context a little bit is if you look at 2017, even as an example, we end up investing a lot of capital in 2017, but for a good portion of the year, it looked like that wasn't necessarily going to be the case. And there some private equity deals move very quickly between when you negotiate the transaction, agree to do them, sign and close, you know, and that tends to be a very compressed time period. Other times there can be many months of lag between when you strike a deal and then when it actually funds and therefore would show up here. So I'd say that our deal pace in terms of number, as Paul alluded to, the number of transactions that we've been working on has never been stronger across our platform. It's just a question, as Paul said, of which ones we decide to do, and then once we decide to do them, the time frame it takes between signing and closing, and therefore showing up on a schedule of investments. So I would expect the pace to continue to be strong. And Paul, do you anything else you want to comment on that, Paul?
No, I mean, I would agree that that obviously there looks like there's a large cash balance. We're always careful about how we manage our cash, both when we have a cash balance and when we're using the credit facility, in terms of how that affects our investment pace. But we do have quite a large number of things going on, and a lot of those hopefully will close, as Peter mentioned, in the second half of the year. So I think the pace probably isn't fairly reflected in what's shown on these pages in terms of how busy we've been. But equally, we are under no pressure to invest that cash. And again, if you look back at our investment pace relative to our cash balance, there's not always a direct correlation there. So in 2016, we didn't invest very much, but we had a fairly large cash balance. In 2017, we saw what we thought were more interesting deals, and so did invest more. And that's really how we work, obviously based on a bottom-up underwriting, first and foremost.
Great. Thank you.
Your next question comes from Charles Murphy from Panmure Gordon.
Gentlemen, good morning. Couple of questions, but can we start with the income portfolio? I note between the Q1 presentation and this presentation, the yield to maturity has spiked out a bit, and also you've now removed the no longer 100% 100% performing credits has gone as well. So can you talk us through what's going on, what percentage of the portfolio is in trouble or having issues, and just try and get a sense of what's going on there? And was this what was driving your Q1 mark-to-market, your valuation issues?
Peter, shall I take that?
Please.
So there is one position of note which has traded down, as John alluded to, in the IRRs, the annual numbers. And so that one position obviously has been marked down. That was reflected really throughout the year. So you're right that during Q1, that was part of the negative performance. There were obviously a number of positions that were up that balanced that. But yes, that was reflected in Q1, and there were further markdowns in that particular position during Q2. So I think that one position is really the cause of the IRR change, as well as the difference in the yield to maturity. Other things have moved around a little bit, but there's only one thing that I would say is kind of on our watch list.
Absent that, have you any idea what your performing credits yield to maturity is then? Because it's obviously having a big distorting factor.
It is. I don't know that number off the top of my head. It's something we could certainly look into, including in future materials.
Excellent. Thank you. That would be good. While we're going through the presentation, slide 8, I was trying to work out, and may have misheard the gentleman speaking, but was that the May 18 data? Was that this year's data, or was that last 12 months' data? I couldn't hear the...
Sorry, which
slide 8?
Right, it's as marked, right?
As marked, so it's the last 12 months, not
yes.
Not in 2018. Okay. And then there's a sort of limited amount of, when do you expect the sort of next valuation marks you're going to get from your GP partners to come through and be reflected in the NAV? I'm thinking, of course, at the end of the year, your first go at the December NAV then changes when you publish the accounts. Because the first half performance, I presume, is lagging a bit in terms of just news flow.
Yeah, you're exactly right. And typically what we find is that the Q1 valuations, because they follow the more intensive Q4 valuations, tend to not change very much in terms of the private marks in both the fund portfolio and the co-investments, unless there's something just really notable, either in terms of company performance or change in the comparable companies. So Q2, the June 30th numbers, likely will be coming out in the August timeframe for the most part. So we'll include as many of those as we possibly can in our Q2 valuations and that report. And that's really the next valuation event. And of course, then you have half a year from the audited numbers, and they do tend to move a little bit more. So that would be the next notable one. But I will say the co-investments are more granular in terms of the valuation than funds as a whole. So we do mark those, and we do follow those investments closely and can, I think, be more accurate with our assessment of how each company is doing than you can in a fund. And, of course, the funds are winding down. One thing I'll also note on this page, on page 8, while as of May 18th, the fund portfolio is down 1%, there were several exits from one fund in particular, or actually two funds, one GP in particular, which should have a positive impact on that when we get those June 30th numbers that you refer to. So hopefully that will bring that back to a positive number.
One other thing to just add on that is just to remind you, you probably remember, but we actually roll through our valuation information monthly as we get it. So while the June 30, not monthly statement, but the June 30 full report will include the valuation changes that we've been talking about here, you'll also start to see in the July monthly, for example, and things like that, you'll start to see some of those rolling through. So that's maybe one difference between the way that we're presenting our information from some of our peers, is that we roll it through as we get it, and so it's less of a dramatic jump on the semi-annual report, for example, and you get a bit more in the monthlies as you're leading up to that.
Excellent. Sorry, if I may, I've got a couple more questions. U.S. corporate taxation came down. Is that impacting the dynamic in the private equity market? Are there more strategic buyers going, well, I've got cash to spare? Or is it too early to tell? And then also, can you then talk about the portfolio revenue growth, which was weak, but I suspect I'm looking at old numbers at the moment, and I'm just wondering whether you've got any color on that, because the EBITDA is great, it's the revenue has been a bit weak.
Yeah, so on the corporate taxation front, I'd say there is that the general view and the anecdotal evidence is that that's exactly as you described, that it's increasing the buying power of U.S. corporates, and that's good for private equity exits. We're also seeing anecdotally more U.S. corporates just involved in processes, and I don't think it's just the tax rate. Also has to do with the fact that you saw from the multiples that Paul showed there, having their stocks be highly valued also is a good thing for them as buyers, right? Their corporates are more likely to buy when their stock prices are high. And so those are all things that are positives for the exit environment to U.S. corporates. Paul, do you want to take the revenue number?
Sure, yeah. So first of all, Charlie, you're right that the numbers are a little bit dated. We update those twice a year based on our December numbers and then in our Q2 report. So we'll be doing that in the Q2 report when that comes out. So, you know, I think that's the first point. The second really is the 2% revenue growth obviously contains a large part of very new investments. So they tend to, at least there are several cases where we're acquiring companies which hadn't been performing particularly well, and that's included in there. So the 33% or I forget the exact number, but the number of 36% in 2017 investments is included in there, and there are a number of cases where there are companies which just haven't been able to execute under private equity ownership yet, and we would hope that that number would increase. I'll also say that we did change the methodology of our calculation in that to, I think, make it more representative and weighted appropriately by the companies. And so that was one change that we made, which, you know, shouldn't obviously affect one way or another. But I will say, as you're looking back and comparing, then you should look at the footnotes and look at the difference in the value and in the methodology that we employed in doing that.
Thank you. I'll stop asking questions. That's been very helpful.
Your next question comes from Ian Scaller from Stifel.
Good morning. I was wondering if you'd just talk a bit about realization prospects. I know you've got 18% of the portfolio in technology, and obviously that's been a particularly strong sector over the last couple of years, and we've seen quite a lot of IPOs in that area of the market.
Yeah, so, you know, I think broadly across the portfolio, we think we have a lot of companies that are performing well across all the different sectors. I will say we've done, until very recently at least, less in the technology space simply because exactly what you said, that new investments have generally been harder to come by at valuations we liked. So historically, we'd been very active in technology. In the last 12 months to 18 months, we'd been relatively less. So, you know, putting that statement together and what it implies is that there are some older investments in technology investments that should be reaching that exit window. And that's really how I look at the portfolio. I mean, I'm referring to slide 14, that broadly in those vintage years, as I mentioned in 2013 and 14, those companies really should be in the exit window in this type of environment. And I think there are many cases that we would believe those companies are. Obviously, we don't control the exit timing in these investments, but mostly we're highly aligned with the GPs in these investments in terms of wanting realizations at the right point in companies, and I think a lot of them in 13 and 14 are there. So I would say there's good prospects. I can't say it'll be as good as 2017 was because the portfolio has gotten a little bit younger, but there are, I think, good prospects, and there are certainly companies which probably shouldn't name, but as we look through the portfolio that appear to be doing well, appear to be probably in the shop window waiting for the right offer to come along. And it's really that type of market that GPs who own companies that are performing well all have a price that will clear. But because it's a competitive market, there's also that the fact that if you own a good company that is performing well, you need to get a really attractive offer to make you want to sell it, because obviously those GPs then need to turn around and make new investments. And so I think there is a little bit of that in there too, that there are a lot of good companies out there that we could tell you would be good exit candidates, but it's just a question of the right offer coming along, and it's always hard to predict that timing.
Okay, thank you very much.
Your next question comes from Matthew Hose from Jefferies.
Morning. Is it possible to get a bit more of an update on the fund portfolio, specifically how many underlying investments are left and what is the average uplift on exit, given that we normally see lower uplifts on pre-crisis vintages? Thanks.
We have them in the back, right? Yeah, so the full listing...
Page 23, yeah. Page 23 is the list.
At the back. And the numbers, but the number of funds has not changed notably, I would say, over the last 12 months. There are funds which are reaching liquidation. In terms of the average uplift, I don't have that data in front of me. I would say, in general, I agree that older companies, you do tend to see less uplift, although contrary to that, as I mentioned, there are several exits that I know of, reasonably notable exits that I know of in the portfolio, which happened in the second quarter, which were at a very healthy markup. So in general, I agree with the comments that you tend to see older companies generate less value at this point in their lives, but there are always exceptions, and fortunately, we've seen some of those exceptions. You know, I think as we've discussed on a number of occasions, much like I just described, GP is always waiting for the right price to come along when they're looking at their companies. We are always willing to sell funds, and we're always trying to keep up to date with what each of the funds, as well as the portfolio as a whole, is worth. And over time, we have sold in secondaries. We are exploring that almost on an ongoing basis. And so, again, we may decide to sell some of these positions in secondaries over time. But over the last 12 months, we have not done that.
That's really helpful. Thanks.
Your next question comes from Lewis Margolis from Select Advisors.
Good morning, gentlemen. As you know, I bought my original position in 2008 and bought it at just about every integer all the way up. I recently bought a fairly large amount, increasing my position by a sizable percentage. In the London shares, averaging about 970. I hear you saying you're being very selective. I think that's great. You recently raised money a little over 4%. The economics of buying in some of these London shares under 1,000 seems very, very compelling. Why are you not doing that?
Well, there's a couple of things there. Just one thing, just quickly, thank you very much for your support, and we appreciate you and the other long-term shareholders that have been part of the shareholder base at NBPE. So first of all, thank you. Second of all, just we have the London and we have the Euronext. Just I know this wasn't part of your question, but just make sure we put it out there. We still have the Euronext listing. As you all know, from a trading volume perspective, relatively little gets traded on Euronext, and we are actively pursuing whether or not we can efficiently just delist from Euronext and have it just be in London. So just throwing that out there as well. In terms of return of capital to shareholders, that is something we are always actively considering. As you know, during the financial crisis, we bought back just shy of 10% of the stock at very low prices. One thing that we are focused on, though, is there is clearly a correlation between the size of vehicles and the discounts at which they trade, meaning that the larger vehicles tend to trade at narrower discounts than the smaller, less liquid ones. And so while we have to trade off the short-term arbitrage effect that you're describing from the a couple of other things, which include how do we make sure that the vehicle is of size over time, that it can be most liquid and therefore trade in that peer group of larger, more liquid names. So that's a key consideration that we factor in as well. Also, when we're looking at returning capital to shareholders, we do look at both the returning capital to shareholders through dividends as well as through share repurchases. And as you know, we've been very active in terms of paying of dividends. We've paid out a lot of capital in dividends over the years. And so that's something, and there's a trade-off there between the share repurchases and the dividends. And so, you know, that's the dividend is something that we have gotten feedback from investors that they very much appreciate that aspect of the stock. And so that's the path that we've been using most recently, but we always actively consider other options, but just the board in recent years has determined that the dividends have been the most appropriate. But those are all the various factors that we consider when making the determination.
I think you forgot to mention your fee income.
That is not a factor in our decision process. It just isn't.
The economics of buying, what I do is I take my dividend, and I'm happy to have it, believe me. I take the dividend and I wait, and eventually it goes to, like it did recently. And not only did I reinvest my dividends the last few years, but I put in more cash. You guys are doing a great job on NAV, no question about it. But if you're raising money at 4%, or 4 1/8, or a quarter, your ability to arbitrage this is tremendous if you can buy stuff below a 20% discount. It just economically, even a small amount, and it would, I guarantee you, it would help you get to be better recognized for your terrific performance, because at least there's some bottom. You know, if we get into another ugly environment, the way this fund is set up, we could trade to a 30% discount. Even if you said something like, we'd be very inclined to be a buyer at a 20% discount. Put some sense of a floor in here. And this doesn't make any sense. I was buying stuff at a 25% discount. I shouldn't complain, I suppose.
No, I appreciate the feedback. As I say, we have shown over time the willingness to do that. Say we have the various factors that we consider, and the board actively considers these at every board meeting. We actually go, you know, we do go through and think about where the pluses and minuses, but we have to look at all the factors, not just about a short-term trading opportunity, but actually thinking through the various factors.
I have heard that line for 5 years. I don't think you bought any stock in the last 5 years, have you?
We have not. However, we have gone and paid out
the dividend.
Many, many tens of millions of dollars of dividend.
But none of these, all these activities have not reduced the discount. Bottom line, the discount has never was as large as it's been except for the crazy period of 08. The discount was as large as it's been in the last several months. I'm not sure what I said was English, but close enough. You get my point.
Understand the point. We also
you guys do a good job.
Business.
You've done a good job with this. I think it's great. I'm a happy shareholder. I've been here now 10 years, and as I said, I increased my position by about a third recently. I think you're doing a disservice to the shareholders. I'm going to be here for the. I'm never selling the stock. I got a ridiculous cost. So, thank you very much. I appreciate it.
Thanks, Mike.
Your next question comes from Miles Stodd from Stodd Capital.
Good afternoon, guys. And I just wanted to follow on from the question from the gentleman from Select. I think everyone on the call would benefit a little bit from a discussion about the discount and maybe to relay some of the thoughts that go on in the board's head, because the situation today is quite extreme. The arguments you've just wheeled out are pretty tepid. And I guess the two questions about the turn into two questions would be, does the board think the current discount is acceptable? And does the board think that this is a sustainable long-term proposition for shareholders?
So a couple of things there. We care very much about the discount. We care even more about making sure that NAV and stock price grow, right? So the key is actually...
But if the share price doesn't have any bearing on the NAV, then shareholders only own the share price. I can understand why NAV is important for the manager.
Right. So but that's why I said both, just to be clear.
Right.
I said both share price and NAV are critical, right? Because partly because you can't just have share price without NAV growth, right?
Yeah, this discount level, you can, there's a lot of room for share price growth without any change in the NAV, but we'll put that point to the side perhaps.
Yeah, right. The other thing there is we do live within the environment of listed private equity, right? So there's a range of different discounts that different stocks trade at, but we have to live within that market environment. As I say, when we look at these opportunities here or look at the different actions that we can be taking, we are very much focused on what is the right thing to do for the long term here. And we're focused not just, though, on, okay, can we do a trade today to go and make the stock go up if it's just going to go back down again the moment you stop buying, right? And so what we do look at, though, is overall the capital return policy. We've sent back tens and tens and tens of millions of dollars to shareholders. We've done that every year. And that's something that we absolutely plan on continuing to do. We regularly review what is the right level for the dividend on the stock. As I say, our next board meeting will be having exactly a similar discussion on that point. It is absolutely clear, though, that when you look at listed vehicles, you tend to find that if you have vehicles that are declining in their overall size, they tend to be less liquid over time. And therefore,
I'd say that's quite a debatable point. I think pretty much everyone on the call would debate you on that point. But I guess the specific question I asked was, does the board think the current situation is acceptable? And if not, what is the current plan to fix the problem? Because a lot of what you've been saying now, all of us have heard for quite some time.
So do we find the current situation acceptable? No, we don't think it's appropriate. And we're continuing to look at what the various options are. And we'll continue to review them, and we'll continue to take actions that we feel are appropriate. But what we're not going to do, though, is go and do a big buyback program with the thought then of pumping up the stock for a couple of weeks so some people can trade out.
I don't think anyone would rationally think that a well-managed capital management program is an effort to pump up the stock. You've got a lot of long-term investors. There's obviously a clear accretion point, and I guess counter to the rather tepid look-across arguments that you're making is a very real argument that this is a financial product, and ultimately supply and demand have to meet. So with a discount as extreme as yours, it's very hard to put forward that there is actually the amount of demand in the market necessary for the stock. And I mean, just following on from what the guy Tlick said, I think you're doing yourself a huge disservice. The story itself is wonderful. The performance has been fantastic. So there's either, you know, a lack of appetite to get out and market the story, or a lack of appetite for the story.
Sorry, it's an important point that you're
making.
Sorry, just one thing, and it is an important point that you raised about lack of marketing. One effort that we have been making, we've done a lot of work to look at our shareholder base, where our shareholder base relative to other comparable vehicles, and where are we appropriately represented, where are we underrepresented. One area that we have been focusing in on materially over the last 12 months, and it's an important point, is that we realized, and this was an important aspect of us moving to the main board in London, we realized that our shareholder base was underrepresented in more the high net worth or more retail oriented community in the UK. And so it was critical for us to move to London, have a sterling listing. But then also those were necessary but not sufficient conditions to having our stock be accessible to that whole investor base. So that's something, those are things that we did. We've also been doing concerted marketing efforts towards that whole investor base, because that investor base, what we've found is they've historically bought more just names that they were familiar with, as opposed to having it be performance, having it be as performance based as perhaps we would think it should be. And so we've been doing a material outreach program going after that investor base to educate them about NBPE as a stock. And we have seen real signs of that investor base beginning to buy. And that is an important aspect because it is critical in these sorts of vehicles to be involved in outreach programs and making sure that investors are aware of the stock and the story and the performance that we've had. So that has been a concerted outreach effort and an activity that we've been putting a lot of time and resources into.
Well, sure. So I hope that continues. I guess the final comment I would make would be more, the notion that we're looking at all sorts of options and we don't get anywhere flies for a little while. But I guess that sort of line has gone on for some time now. And I think you're going to find a lot of investors like myself and the chapters on the phone just before getting increasingly tired with a lack of any actual conclusion or solving of this serious problem. But I'll leave it there. Thank you for the chance to ask a few questions.
And I show no further questions at this time.
Great. Well, thank you very much, everyone.
Thank you.
Ladies and gentlemen, this does conclude today's conference. Thank you for your participation. You may now disconnect.